Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Dr. Becker is a professor at Texas Women's University, and he has a background in both motor behavior and sports psychology. Are there certain skills where a holistic focus makes more sense? We're more versed in volleyball where we have lots of random skills, like you said, where it depends on, you know, maybe when I'm hitting the ball, when I'm attacking the ball, it depends on the quality of the set.
Sure.
Or another skill like serving, where I have a lot more control over a lot of the elements of it. So do you think certain areas where holistic makes more sense, or is it good across the board?
I think it's a little bit early to make a real broad conclusion on that, since we've really only got a couple studies out right now with the holistic focus. I think the thing I would say, you know, the differences between the skills you just mentioned in a serve, I'm very much in control. It's more of a self-paced skill. I mean, you can't stand there and wait forever, but you're not immediately reacting to something someone else did. You're really in control. And so you have a little bit more time and control where you can develop a specific focus plan. I think a lot of the other skills that you have in volleyball, it is very reactive. And so it's not, in my perception as somebody that really has never played volleyball at a competitive level, there's not a lot of time to develop a lot of complex thoughts of what I want to focus on. And so I might try to keep those things really simple. And so it's in my perception would be when someone's playing really well, when you get into really good back and forth playing volleyball, is there a lot of thought that's going on, or is it much more reaction just to where the ball's going and trying to get to the next hit?
I'd say reaction.
Yes. Yeah, so again, it happens in such a short amount of time. There's not a lot to think about. And so in those scenarios, I don't think I would probably try to overprescribe a whole lot of anything. It might be, you know, a basic external cue might be in some, you know, watching some of the things you guys do on the court, especially in beach sometimes it might just be getting under the ball. I mean, it's really just about getting the ball back up in the air to your teammate to be able to hit it. And so I don't know that there's a lot of need for really over prescribing a focus plan there. It would just be kind of a quick reaction. Another area that I think kind of falls within an external focus, when we think about an external focus, we've talked about, a target of where I want the ball to go to. We could talk about maybe the contact with the ball, just making contact with the ball. And so a lot of that stuff is more, some of it's visual based with the target of where we want to go to. I think another thing that can work well in certain sports is thinking about what is the auditory effect of a movement. So when I hit a ball really well, what does that sound like? And maybe it's focusing on that sound, or maybe it's focused on the feeling of solid contact on the ball. So I think when you have a good hit, bad hit, it's going to generate for one a different sound and another a different kind of feeling or sensation. And so that I don't think we need to paint that stuff into a box if it's an external or a holistic focus, but just focusing on that, on one of those sensations of either the sound or the feeling of making solid contact with the ball might be another way to have a really simplistic focus that's not going to take up much of your attention. So you can still have a pretty free mind just to be able to allow yourself to react and play once you're on the court.
And you've given us some examples of, I guess, choosing the appropriate holistic cue for different skills. How do you know if it's working and when you should change it up and maybe try a different cue?
So I think that the general thing I'd say from the coaching perspective is, you know, when we do this in research in the study, an attentional focus study, we want experimental control, we want consistency. And so we are using the same cue throughout. And so we've identified a cue that we think is relevant to the task that fits in whatever categories, internal, external, holistic, that we're trying to assess. I think in the coaching world, cueing becomes very, very individual, and you need to figure out what is going to work well for that athlete. So I would kind of start with some trial and error, and then getting into the practice setting, try to assess how that's going. So if I give you a particular focus cue and suddenly we're not going to try it just once, but you're going to go through and get some attempts on that. And between you as the coach and the feedback of the athlete, try to figure out, do we think this is going well? Some cues I might think are going to work really well, and I get in there and try it and it just doesn't seem to work. And so then we try to find something else that fits within the confines of one of the preferred types of attentional focus that that we want to work with. And so it's, I would say it comes down to just the feedback of, is the skill improving? Are you hitting well? Does it help the athlete feel confident? Because if those things aren't working, then regardless of what type of cue it is, it's not worth continuing. We want to find something else that works.
Awesome. Well, now we're going to talk about the mental game and get into some of your own career. You're a competitive hammer thrower. What drew you to that?
So my start in the hammer throw was, I mean, almost by accident, I would say. I started as a track and field athlete in high school because my football coach told me to go out and start sprinting so I could get faster. And then I quickly realized I was pretty slow in terms of sprinting and started into the throwing events. And the hammer throw is not in almost all states in the U.S., the hammer throw is not a high school event. It's pretty much college and beyond. And so toward the end of my senior year in high school, my high school throwing coach had thrown hammer in college and kept telling me, I think you'd be really good at this. You should try it. And I tried it a couple of times with him. And then I'd been recruited to University of Wisconsin Lacrosse, Division III school. And I was recruited there to play football. And so I went there to play football and then just happened to walk into the track coach's office and ask if I could walk onto the team. And it became very clear that I was a much better hammer thrower than I was anything else. I was high school discus and shot put thrower, was really invested, working really hard, working my tail off, and was still just never qualified for a state meet. And the hammer throw, pretty much the first time I picked it up, it was just going really far. And so I continued on that through college. And then about 5 years after college, was able to throw twice in the Olympic trials. And so it very almost instantly became a passion. It was so much fun. And after working hard for so long at other events and being just kind of okay, it was like I finally found my event and my calling in terms of athletics. And so it took up several years of my life, but it was really fun.
Yeah, I saw a couple of videos you have on YouTube of you throwing. And I don't think I've watched a lot of hammer throw, but it's pretty amazing to watch and looks incredibly dangerous as well.
It can but, be, yes.
So are you're not still competitively throwing the hammer?
Pretty recreationally. I actually had started training a little bit in this off season. Okay. And I threw in the last NCAA meet before the NCAA season was canceled. So it was a mid-March local meet at UT Arlington. And I got one throw in and was kind of contemplating some more competitions, but then season ended. And so here it is. So it's at this point, I still like it. I still have interest, but my interest really has gone from, initially I was hoping to make an Olympic team, didn't make it that far, but at this point it's two things for me. It's I still have this draw and desire to master the skill. I feel like I've not mastered the skill technically. And so that's kind of a motivator for me. And it's something fun to go out and be active. I like that a lot more than going out for a jog or something. So it's kind of recreational. And then still it's on the same side in terms of the mental game and different things with motor behavior, it's kind of an active research lab for me just to go try things and try to figure it out.
Yeah. Also a good COVID sport as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Are there things you learned through, you know, getting your PhD and learning more about motor behavior, motor learning that you wish you could tell your, you know, maybe as a football player or as a hammer thrower that you could have told yourself as you're learning?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that, you know, things like, I mean, attentional focus, I think, is a huge part of a skill like that. When we look at the throwing events, it's, you know, it's maybe a little bit similar to what you guys do with serving, where it's a pre-planned skill. It's self-paced and you have a lot of time to be in your own head. And so your own thoughts and your attentional focus becomes important. I think the other thing I wish I'd known about was a little bit more about practice specificity. And so I think this happened for me, and I think this happens for a lot of athletes, where I honestly had a motor learning problem that turned into a sports psychology problem. So I had especially in my college days throwing the hammer, I had a lot of problems with fouling. So either I would, you know, in hammer, it's similar to shot put, where we have a 7 foot circle, and if you step out of that circle, it's a foul. And then we have sector lines, and if you throw outside of the sector lines, it's a foul. And so I had early on in my career, especially, a big problem with fouling. And so that led to kind of some meet anxiety and stuff, competition anxiety. And the anxiety certainly was an issue that had to be managed. But if you look a little bit deeper about where did this anxiety problem come from, it came from the problem that nine times out of 10, when I was practicing, I was fouling. But in practice, it was easy just to kind of dismiss that and say, on Saturday, when we get to the meet, I'll be able to stay in the ring. And then on Saturday, I get to the meet and I've hardly stayed in the ring all week in practice. And now I'm under pressure and I'm going to try to do this. And so it really was there was certainly an anxiety component in the meet that had to be dealt with. But a lot of it was the underlying problem of the way I was practicing. When I got that under better control to where I could consistently stay in the ring, throw in the sector, the meet anxiety was gone. So I think that's kind of an important lesson and why, you know, the academic program I went through, my PhD at the University of Tennessee, it's to my knowledge, the only program in the country that formally combines motor learning and sports psychology to understand how they interact and how both those things can really have a big impact on your performance.
The mental side and what you've learned about sports psychology that you would have applied, question is, John, but I guess specifically first, what would you have done in that situation when you are facing that anxiety in the tournament?
In terms of anxiety, I think the most easy and the most portable thing we can all do is different breathing exercises. With those, we want to make sure we're practicing that ahead of time. So we've gotten used to managing our anxiety through breathing. And so I would say a combination of breathing and a focus plan. So I can recall, so my second Olympic trials was 2012. I was already a PhD student at the University of Tennessee, and I was actually able to work with a sports psychologist that whole year. Craig Risberg is the guy I worked with. And one of the things we worked on was we worked a lot on a focus plan for the competition. And then we also just kind of worked on some basic things of when the doubts come up, when anxiety comes up, how do you deal with it? And I remember when I first got interested in learning about the mental game and studying sports psychology, my whole approach was if I can learn how to do this, if I can get my mental game under control, I'll never have to deal with anxiety in a meet. And that, I mean, it really couldn't be farther from the truth. Those, your kind of negative self-talk, the self-doubt is always going to be there. The difference is what do you have in your toolbox to deal with it? And so I think on the physical side, dealing with the, you know, high heart rate, muscle tension, to me, breathing, learning, developing some really basic breathing exercises helped with that. And then on the cognitive side, getting rid of those negative or worrying thoughts. I mean, things, the fouling thoughts, the worries about fouling, worries about not making a final or something, not qualifying. That stuff's always going to creep up, but it's when that comes into your mind, recognize it, get rid of it and replace it with something else. So it's having a deliberate plan of when that happens, what am I going to do about it? It makes it a lot more settling and you can keep it in control then.
That's great. So for, again, back to all that you've learned through, getting your PhD both in the sports psychology and the motor behavior side, if you could go back and coach your coaches, maybe when you're playing football or as you're first learning the hammer throw, is there any kind of feedback you would be giving to them, kind of looking back on it?
Yeah, I think on the motor behavior side, it would just be really about kind of a specificity of practice thing. So if we have an athlete that has trouble staying in the ring, or relating this to your guys' sport, if you have somebody that has struggled serving, either hitting the ball into the net or hitting it out of bounds, and really just can't be consistent in putting the ball where they want it to go, let's make sure we're addressing that stuff in practice. And so practice is not just a means of kind of refining other elements. And if you fouled in practice, we're not going to worry about that right now, because right now we're working on this other part of the technique. I think a good part of practice has to replicate the demands of competition. And so in my example, my problems with staying in the ring or throwing within the sector is let's make a deliberate plan where in practice, we're going to track out of all the, if you take 25 throws, we want to know how many of those throws were legal throws that would count for a mark in a meet. And if we're at 24 out of 25 throws aren't going to be a mark, that's a problem. And so that's our starting point. We're going to try to get to a point where we're continuing to work on other portions of your technique, but we're also really going to make sure you're continually getting success and staying in the ring. I think that one of the, you know, when we think about self-efficacy or situation-specific self-confidence, the prime predictor of whether or not you feel confident is, do you have prior positive experiences where you were able to succeed. So in practice, it's not a meet, but in practice, if you can stay in the ring 24 out of 25 times, or even if it's 20 out of 25 times, you're going to feel a lot better going into the competition than if you are having the opposite problem where 20 out of 25 times you're not staying in the ring. So I think it's about creating successful experiences, creating practices that replicate the demands of the competition environment.
I picture you ignoring all your coach's internal cues about your footwork and just thinking smooth and having your own standard.
It's funny. And that, I mean, I've tried to apply this a lot in my throwing. And, you know, you mentioned before, like, why do you need something other than an external focus? I actually had a really hard time using an external focus in hammer throwing. It's in the hammer throw. I mean, it's the ball and chain. So I'm holding onto a handle. I've got about a 3-foot wire and then basically a shot put on the end of that wire. And so, you know, thinking about some of the research that we have with an external focus, my first thought was, okay, let's focus on the movement of the hammer instead of focusing on what my body's doing. And in the hammer throw, for me at least, that didn't work very well. It still seemed like too much conscious control, where I was trying throughout 3 or 4 revolutions through the ring, I was trying to think about what the hammer was doing. And what I actually, in 2012, the cue I ended up using was actually, to me, the one word cue was just direction. And to me, where that came from was when I was throwing really well, I felt really good direction across the ring. I could feel myself, you know, I'm spinning in circles, but I'm progressing well across the ring. I have good kind of linear energy going along with the rotations. And so just focusing on direction, that was one simple word that to another athlete probably means nothing. But to me, it reminded me of this feeling or the sensation of what a good throw feels like. And so that was my one simple word that I would constantly come back to. And that was about my final season, really training competitively in the hammer.
Cool. And you mentioned some basic breathing exercises. Can you explain that on this podcast? And do you do it like pregame or right before you throw?
Yeah. So the way I've used it is, you know, it's a basic deep breathing exercise. And so well before we're getting to the competition, if I was working with a group of athletes, what we would do is really just learn how to do diaphragmatic breathing. So I'm not breathing just shallowly through my chest, but I'm taking a long, deep breath, first completely exhaling, getting everything out of my lungs, taking a long, deep breath where I feel my abdomen rise, and then feel my chest rise, hold that real briefly, and then a long, slow exhalation. And initially, this isn't what we're going to do in competition, but what I like to have athletes do initially is we're just going to practice that for 5 or 10 minutes. And we're going to do that. We might practice that every day. We might practice that a few times a week, but the goal of that really is to get used to the idea of lowering your heart rate, lowering your breathing rate, feeling that sense of calm. Once we've practiced that, once we've gotten pretty good at that, in the actual moment of the competition, for example, before I'm going to serve the ball, I don't need to get completely relaxed. Like I'm laying down on a yoga mat, feeling Zen. I need to get to a point where I don't feel tense. And so what I'm doing in that scenario is one really deep breath in, slow breath out. And if I've practiced deep breathing, 1 or 2 breaths like that should get me from maybe a 10 back down to a 7 or 8, if that's where I want to get to. And so the goal is, for one, let's first get really good at just using deep breathing to calm our body, calm our mind. But then in the moment of the competition, when I need to, for maybe for lack of a better term, take the edge off, get myself from a overexcited or overly anxious point back to a manageable point where I can use the extra energy of competition to help me instead of hurt me, then 1 or 2 deep breaths right before I need to perform a skill might get me there.
And since John was like always asleep when he played, did he take short breaths to fire himself up?
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, the opposite. Sometimes we call it power breaths, but it's, Watch any weightlifting competition, like a powerlifting competition. You'll see these people inherently doing it. They probably have no idea that we call it power breathing, but it's just a few quick breaths, quick hard breaths. And if I do that, if we put a heart rate monitor on you and you do three quick hard breaths like that, your heart rate's going to go up, your energy goes up a little bit. And so if you're an athlete that's kind of feeling too flat, or if you feel like you need to increase your energy, it's just on the other side, kind of quick short power breaths, as opposed to long, deep breaths to bring your energy down a little bit.
Cool. And then finally, most athletes spend a lot more time on the physical end of the sport than the mental side. What would you say is the area that has the biggest return on investment for athletes to practice their mental game?
I'm going to answer this in two ways. I think the first thing, like I've talked about a lot already, is developing a plan to manage your focus and manage your thoughts. I think with the research I do, with the perspective, with my experience, I think that's one of the most powerful things you can do. The second thing I would say more broadly is more important than anything is don't be afraid to seek out help with your mental game. So I think when we think about anything on the either mental health or even mental performance, what we're talking about here really is just kind of the performance side of sports psychology. A lot of times people are avoiding that. There's a stigma with it. There's this idea that if I'm seeking out those services, I have a problem or I don't have a strong mental game. And to me, the most important thing, if you want to reach your peak as an athlete, if you want to perform the best you can, you cannot ignore the mental game. And so in the era that we're in right now with the easy access, meeting with people over Zoom, getting in touch with people, there are a lot of great people out there that can help you to improve your mental game. And this is, if you want to reach your peak performance, it's something you got to do. And so I think that's the message I'd like to get out there more than anything is if you are a competitive athlete that wants to be at your best, the mental game is part of what you work on. I mean, it's similar to strength conditioning. It's similar to developing your technical skills. It's really, really a very important thing. It's something I wish I would have done earlier in my athletic career. And it's really, really a powerful thing that can be a game changer in where you progress to in your athletic career.
That's awesome. Great message. So we just have two more questions from listener Andy Bass. And he has two good questions. The first one is, do you believe there is an actual benefit of having an external focus, or is the paradigm more based on an internal detriment?
I think it's a little bit of both. So I think we definitely know that an internal focus is going to impair our performance because we're taking conscious control over things that shouldn't be consciously controlled. But an external focus, the way it's created, an external focus focuses on the effect in the environment. So it's, in a lot of cases, it's my planned outcome. So in volleyball, it's the target of where I want to put the ball, for example. When we plan our movements at the level of the outcome, we can achieve more self-organization. So I think it's a little bit of both. An internal focus, a focus can hurt us. An external focus can help us by some of the things that it does. I personally don't think it's the only thing that can help us get to that point.
Nice. And then last one from Andy is, what do you find is the reason coaches in the sporting world were and are so enamored with internal focus cues for so long?
You know, I think it's the nature of the way we've been trained for a long time. This, like I said before, was my introduction to the field. Is it just didn't make sense to me with everything I knew as an athlete and as a coach, that an external focus would be the way that we should go. And so I actually spent 3 or 4 years trying to design studies that would show that an internal focus was better if we tweaked it a little bit. So one of those was using an internal focus that was more broad instead of narrow, focused on one joint. Other ones, it was just, we looked at studies and said, you know, I don't think that's a very good cue. I think that's just a poor cue they've selected. Let's use this other cue that we think might work better. And in all my attempts, I've completely failed to show that an internal focus works well. So I think the reason is, as a coach, it's our job to be able to analyze a movement and determine what's wrong or what needs to improve. And so when I do that on the level of analysis, I need to know what the body is doing wrong, what needs to change in the movement. Where I want to really challenge myself as a coach, though, is not just to spit that knowledge out. I want to code that into a way that an athlete doesn't need to break down what they're doing too. And so it's, if I know that here's the issue at the elbow, this is the issue at the shoulder, this is the issue at the wrist, this is the issue. I need to know that as the coach, but then I need to kind of translate that into some language that's going to keep the athlete from kind of breaking down the movement into those tiny little pieces. Especially because we look at, if I'm constantly thinking about all the mechanics of what I'm doing, when I get under pressure, some of our theories with anxiety and choking says, again, I'm going to go back and I'm going to reinvest and think about all those things. And so if I've done that, it makes it really hard for me to be successful. So as a coach, again, want to emphasize, I need to know how to break down the skill. but then challenge ourselves when we go to our instructions or to our feedback that we're giving athletes, think about, is there a different way I can present that I don't need to overload them with that knowledge of the body mechanics of it.
Right. That's awesome to hear that you really kind of challenge the internal focus. Cause I've learned about the external focus, and I feel like I see Dr. Wolf quoted all the time. And then I just picture Dr. Wolf found it, so everyone just bows down and that must be right. But it's cool to hear that people, you know, were challenging it and you were challenging it, and that helped you get to the point that you're at now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with this being this area of research has been really active for 20 plus years now. And mm-hmm. I think over that time, you know, any good finding like this is going to withstand the test of time. If it's
right.
If the results only occurred out of one lab or a couple studies, then it probably doesn't tell us very, very strongly that that's really a strong principle. But I mean, there are countless number of different researchers and different labs that have tested this, have looked at different nuances, and it really is very clear that an external focus works well. Where we're trying to go right now, where I've focused a lot of my energy, is figuring out, based on things we're hearing from other athletes, based on some other paradigms like a holistic focus, are there other things that we can do that might work well? Because we do continually hear from coaches or athletes, I don't know how to fix this with an external focus, or I don't, for this skill, we had planned to start a study. One of the areas this comes up a lot in is in things like dance or gymnastics, where the whole goal is to get to generate a specific movement and make your body look a certain way. So how do you direct your attention away from the body? There are a few examples of studies that have shown a benefit to external focus cues, but coming up with the cues is really hard. And so one of the areas we want to study with a holistic focus is skills like that. We've been planning a study with looking at the performance of a pirouette dance move. But mm-hmm. with all the COVID stuff, we're pretty much on hold for most of our data collection. So it's been a little difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting to hear about kind of the new frontier in motor learning, and I'm excited to follow along, because I think the holistic focus just give coaches one more tool in the toolbox and ways that they can help their athletes. So thanks for doing what you're doing, and excited to follow along and learn more as you go.
It's been great, and I appreciate that people like you are so invested in figuring out how do we translate this to the coaching world. And for me it's just as important to get out and hear from coaches what's actually going on, so that we can try to put both sides together and discover something new, basically, to move the field forward.
Cool. Well, this was great. Well, thanks so much for your time. We're happy to be your lab rats as coaches anytime you need. If there's something you want to try out, we'll go try it out. Thanks so much for spending the time and teaching us so much today.
Yeah, it was great to talk with you guys. Thanks.